Welcome to the Sherry Sylvester Show. For the last several years, the Texas Public Policy Foundation has been engaged in producing a film series called Forging Texas to zero in on those moments in Texas when history is being made. Some of those moments are at the top of our legacy list, like the glorious victory of the Texas Patriots over Santa Ana at the Battle of San Jacinto. Other moments in our history are fuzzy and sometimes uncomfortable and need more focus to bring them into view so we can celebrate them and learn more about who we are as Texans and Americans. Today we're going to talk about one of those moments. The early black film industry during segregation, when movies called race films were produced with African American actors and other talent to be shown in segregated movie theaters in Texas and across the South. African Americans were not allowed in most white movie theaters in the North either. They were often required to sit in the balcony or come in at a special time. As many as 500 race films were produced between 1915 and 1950, including a number in Texas. My guest today, Martin Jones, is a two-time Emmy Award-nominated producer, creative innovator, and executive who specializes in producing and directing diverse teams of talented artists and technicians to create multimedia content of all kinds. He's the head of Austin Studios, which is operated by the Austin Film Society, and one of the nation's leading nonprofits. He recently collaborated with TPPF and our leading filmmaker, Stephen Robinson, to produce The Making of a Classic, about a race film that was filmed in Dallas in 1941, entitled The Blood of Jesus, which was written and directed and starred the legendary Spencer Williams. It was the first Texas film to be selected for preservation in the National Film Registry by the Library of Congress. I want to start by showing a scene from Making of a Classic and then talk to Martin about what drew him to this movie, to Spencer Williams, and to partnering with TPPF. But first, let's look at this.
I don't know what you want from me, Mr. Williams.
I don't want anything from you. Just for you to have fun.
Fine.
Yes, ma'am. This is the best job in the world. Ain't it? The work we do? We're blessed. I've been thinking about what you said earlier. I know this movie of ours is not going to be perfect. I know that. And it ain't going to behave like the ones that come out of Hollywood. But it's ours.
But it's ours. Martin, welcome to the Sherry Sylvester Show.
Sherry, thank you for having me. I get choked up on that scene every time. When I read the script, that was really the scene that sealed it for me, that you know, told me I want to meet these people. I want to explore making this film and bringing it to life. I mean, I get goosebumps every time I watch it.
Well, where did you start? So had you been studying Spencer Williams for a long time, or what's your story?
So my story is, you know, I'm a kid who picked up a movie camera in Columbus, Ohio at the age of 10. And before that, I was in my dad's darkroom as young as 5, learning how to mix chemicals. And, you know, I'd set the timer and I'd move the prints from one bath of chemicals to the other. And I'd watch my dad with these little gizmos.
How come your dad had a darkroom?
Because he was a photographer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so my dad was a photographer and didn't do it as a living. He could have, I think, if he was in a different time. But, you know, we were still coming out of segregated America when I was a kid, right? Uh-huh. And so, you know, my dad was this great photographer. My mom was this incredible fashion designer. But the world that they grew up in 1940s America, and when they got together and got married in the late 40s, early 50s, was a different America. And so by the time their youngest kid comes along, number 4, I think it was just like, okay, go to college, do whatever you want. And so being exposed to their creativity, my mom's fashion, my dad's photography, you know, it really captivated me as a kid that you could just sort of reach into the ether and create things. I mean, my mom would take a piece of whole cloth, and the next thing you know, ladies would be coming over and getting fitted, and there'd be a fashion show. And my aunt made the hats, and, you know, it was an amazing thing to see. And so without really knowing it, I was learning production as a kid and creative production as a kid, and being in the dark room and seeing these images be transformed, you know, again, just hitting a mirror and a lens and a camera and then this photochemical process. It was fascinating.
Uh-huh.
And so that was really the beginning of me wanting to be a storyteller. You know, my dad used a cassette. My dad was a mental health professional, and I did a lot of dictation. So when he wasn't doing dictation on his clients, I would use the tape recorder and create these elaborate tales. And that was just the beginning, you know. And Super 8 cameras came out in the 60s, and I picked one up, and that was really the start.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then went to film school. You know, I got to the point where the hobby got too expensive. You know, it wasn't as easy as accessible as it is now technologically then. And, you know, going to film school was transformative. And it was at that point that I came across the story of race films. As much as I had studied film and had favorite filmmakers at that point, I had never heard of these black filmmakers from back in the early days of cinema. So, you know, we've got an industry that's been going for, you know, over a century. And, you know, believe it or not, black filmmakers have been there pretty much from the beginning. Mm-hmm. And, so when this script came to me, a colleague had been approached about producing it. She was busy and said, "Do you know anybody that would be interested in this?" I said, "Well, let me read it, see who I think of." And when I read it, I was like, "I want to do it."
Uh-huh.
Because I had done my thesis on race films. And so that's how I had come to know about Oscar Michaud and Spencer Williams and the Johnson brothers, who had Lincoln Pictures, which is a early studio in L.A. At the beginning of the film industry. So seeing this project, The Making of a Classic, just, you know, put my heart aflutter. And I was like, I have to be a part of helping to make this happen. And to see that the foundation was willing to, you know, focus considerable resources in this series of films, in the Forging Texas series, and seeing the other films that they had made, I was so impressed by the work and the creativity and the storytelling that it was, you know, really an honor to make this number 7 movie in the series.
Well, tell me, in the movie, there's white people and there's African-American people in front of the camera. And I know from reading Spencer Williams that he did a lot of collaborating. Filmmaking is, as you say, a very expensive hobby. You can write.
Yeah.
People can be writers and even painters, but film is expensive. How did they manage this at a time that was not, I mean, starting in 1915, that was not a particularly good time economically for anybody. And
exactly.
For African-Americans, it was worse.
Totally. So. I mean, like, you know, the whole country was... And the world was impacted by the crash in 1929. And ironically, that was the time that movies went from silent pictures to talkies. So it was even more, you know, of a technological lift to get into that. And somehow Oscar Michaud in 1931 made the movie 10 Minutes to Live, an independent sound movie outside of Hollywood. So the tenacity of these filmmakers, I mean, I wish I could go on a time machine and just be on the set with them for a week and see what they did. And, you know, I've joked about that over time. And then when I got this script that A.J. Edwards wrote on the story that Stephen had found, I was like, here's my time machine. Here's a chance to make a movie about the making of a movie. And by people who are my forefathers and foremothers in the black community, creative community. And it was so captivating to see, you know, what they did, because somehow, Sherry, a black man from Louisiana and a Jewish man from Mississippi met in Texas in the late 30s. And Spencer had done a couple movies where he's the heavy. He wasn't, you know, the blundering happy husband that he was in The Blood of Jesus. You know, in Bronze Buckaroo, he plays this son of a gun, you know, bad guy, you know, in a Western. And so he had acted in a couple of pictures that Alfred Sack had produced. somehow, Sherry, 1941 in Dallas, Texas, and Waxahachie, they make this movie, The Blood of Jesus. It goes on to become a big hit on this race film circuit. It's sort of known as a separate cinema. And you alluded to even in the North, there being segregation. They had what they called midnight rambles, you know, when black audiences would come in at late night to, you know, watch movies after the white audience had left. And so this circuit was very big. It stretched from coast to coast and, you know, from south to north, even all the way up to Chicago. And I had the great opportunity of living next door to someone when I was in L.A., an old timer, as we used to say, who worked with Spencer Williams. And so he was the person that told me about Spencer Williams being a filmmaker, not just the actor, because here's a guy who came up in vaudeville, silent pictures, talkies, and then he, after this incredible stretch of a decade in Texas, making 9 movies as a writer, director, and star with Alfred Sack, he goes on to his biggest, most known role on television in the early 50s on CBS as Andy Brown in Amos and Andy. So I knew that version of Spencer Williams, and I knew that he had made a few pictures, but I didn't really know the story until I got into college and as I studied race films. And so the fact that you know, Stephen and his team found this story, and I didn't know that it was connected to Texas. And then the really cool thing, Sherry, is that and my mother-in-law used to live in Tyler, Texas. The hugest, most miraculous thing that ever happened in black cinema happened in East Texas in the mid-80s. A warehouse full of lost films was uncovered, and The Blood of Jesus was amongst those films. And so this whole collection made its way to Dallas to the archives at SMU, at Southern Methodist University. And I knew about that archive. When I was producing music videos, we would go to that archive and get clips to move into these music videos in the 80s and 90s. So I knew about it.
What were they doing in Tyler? I mean,
it was probably the end of a line. You know, there was like these depots. Like, you remember, like today we watch all this, you know, streaming content and broadcast television and all these things. But back in the day, the only entertainment that was visual, you had to go to your cinema. And so you would go there and there would be newsreels and there would be little shorts or what they called serials and then the A movie. But before the A movie would be like the C movie and the B movie.
Right,
you know?
Yeah.
And so at a certain point when it got to the smaller town, sometimes the prints would just stay there because they were chugging out so much stuff and they wanted people in the cinema every week, that it just didn't make economic sense to send it back to Hollywood or New York. And so that's how I think it got piled up in Tyler, and somehow, some way, it just sat hermetically sealed. And, you know, whoever found it had the very good sense to reach out to some historians. And that's how The Blood of Jesus was found.
And yeah, the Gods of Texas, of course it's in Texas.
It was
I want to talk to you a little bit more about Spencer Williams, but first let me ask one more question about the business, because I read that Mr. Sachs, he bought 2 theaters in Dallas. Did movie makers sometimes own theaters?
Yeah, before,
and so were there just
before the federal government stepped in and changed that, movie studios used to own theaters. They were like completely vertically integrated, and that got busted up by the Justice Department or whomever back in the day. But on an independent level, you had a lot of regional people who saw good business in race pictures, and I think Mr. Sack was one of them. I think he started in San Antonio and then made his way up to Dallas. And so what would happen is Oscar Micheaux and other folks would get a movie made.
And just tell us, 2 sentences, who Oscar Micheaux is.
So Oscar Micheaux is considered like the grandfather of black cinema. He started in the silent era, made over 50 movies between 1915 and 1948.
And he was here in Texas, but from somewhere else?
No, so he was born in the plains. He was born in the Dakotas.
Okay.
And became a Pullman porter, lived in New York, lived in Chicago, had this fascinating life as an entrepreneur. But when he was when Oscar Micheaux was a Pullman porter, he would write his books on his breaks. And then as he published the books, he would sell them to passengers on the train and to people along the various stops. And then he raised enough money to make his next book. And so one of his books, The Homesteader, which is about his life as a black man sort of alone in the Dakotas in the turn of the century, the turn of the 20th century, caught the attention of the Johnson brothers, who own Lincoln Pictures in L.A. They sent for him, and on his trip, he talked to enough people and raised money that by the time he got there, and they said they wanted his book, but they wouldn't let him direct it. He said, "I'm making it myself." And so he got a trip to L.A., and this guy figured out what we call now pre-sales. And so he would get some photos and stage some posters, and he would go around and show what his next movie would be. And he would end up at a place like Alfred Sack and say, "You can have my next picture, give me a deposit. And so I'll give it to your theater exclusively and not the other theater." And by the time he got back to New York or Chicago, he had raised enough money to make the movie, and then he would start all over again. And he would take some pictures and posters for the next movie. Fascinating businessman, you know, book publisher, movie maker, you know, entrepreneur, you know, bootstrapper extraordinaire. And so I think by the time Spencer Williams gets into the movie game, it's talkies, it's a well set up, it's a network, it's all these theaters across the country. And so they really, I think, Alfred Sack and Spencer Williams were at the right place at the right time. And I think Texas was sort of at the bullseye of all of this because it was just radiating out across the country.
Uh-huh. So other talent was in Texas as well, actors, and what about camera people? In Making of a Classic, the camera guy is a white guy, but was that just accidental?
Yeah, Jack was a real guy. So Waleed Caldy, who I got to know, who's retired from the SMU Film Archive, made a documentary about Spencer Williams. Our actor, Marcus Henderson, had found it, and I was like, "Oh, I know this director." We tracked him down. We got the DVDs. We're actually inviting him to the screening in Dallas next week.
Oh, great.
And Waleed Caldy did this documentary in the 90s and interviewed the Jack. I mean, two of the crew members, two of these white men were still alive. So we had this excellent first-person narrative about the making of The Blood of Jesus and these movies and Spencer and Alfred as partners in this enterprise. So it was really fascinating. I think we might still have a private link that I could share with you to watch. Just for research. I mean, we bought the DVDs at the educational rate.
Just for research only.
But it's fascinating.
Something occurred to me while you were talking is like a lot of times you never know when you're in history. You know, David McCullough says that we can't imagine when we watch historical figures like Washington or Ben Franklin or whomever, because they don't know how it's going to turn out. Mm. When you're watching it, you don't know how it's going. Right. When the race films began to phase out, it's not like somebody announced, okay, movies are integrated now. I mean, so how did that work? What I read was basically after World War II, people came back and it was no longer viable to have segregated theaters. Well, what does that mean? I mean, World War II ended in 1945. You know, the movies were still going on. So what did that period look like?
I think that period was very interesting because you had, you know, all sorts of businesses in America, you know, waking up and realizing that they were embracing some social practices that didn't make good business sense.
Uh-huh.
You know, they were excluding people who represented, you know, millions, if not billions of dollars in buying power. And so I think, you know, the country changed and, you know, there was...
And people who could go to college too, because
exactly,
of the GI Bill.
Right, because of the GI Bill and all that. And so what you had was, you know, an industry that had gone through big change, because remember the big disruptor, you know, we're talking about AI today.
Uh-huh.
Well, the AI of the early 50s was television.
Right.
Right. And so the studios and that going to the theater every week to watch, you know, 2 or 3 hours of entertainment, news, sports, updates, that was all being replaced by this little box that you could have in your house. And they were expensive, so people would cluster around, you know, the grocer's room or the restaurant or whoever had the ability to buy this expensive device. And as it began to become more accessible, and as, you know, housing in the suburbs and all that changed, you know, people got further away from those neighborhood economic centers, right? Where you went to the grocery store, you went to the funeral parlor, you went to the church, you went to the movie theater. It was all right there, and that all began to change and began to consolidate. So we went from small stores to bigger stores to shopping centers, and that, you know, echoed into the entertainment industry as well. Ironically, when Hollywood was, you know, in the deep, deep doldrums of like potential financial collapse after the big making of the movie Cleopatra, which bankrupted 20th Century Fox almost, you get into this lull in the 70s, and some movies started getting made for black audiences that we now know as a blaxploitation era. Shaft, Buck and the Preacher, mm-hmm. you know, different movies Sidney Poitier was doing. And these movies, the audience was hungry, because now that we had this new form of entertainment, television, well, you still had the same exclusionary practices that existed in the movie house era, uh-huh. but now on television. So you'd gather around the TV as a family. I remember we did, and you'd watch Ed Sullivan, and, you know, everybody in the house would freak out if somebody black was on the show, right? Mm-hmm. So you had the same thing now in television, where it was this mainly, you know, endless amount of incredible entertainment, but white actors and storytellers. And Hollywood's now in their on their last leg and discovers these blaxploitation movies, and they hit like fire. They saved the industry. I mean, mm-hmm. from 1970 to 1980, these pictures really brought about a new American new wave. And then you had these studios with money, and you got now Francis Ford Coppola making The Godfather and other things like that. So
and we learned that those movies weren't just for black people. I mean, everyone.
Exactly. People
that.
Were excited and thrilled to see something different. And so uh-huh. I think that's the great thing about, you know, TPPF doing this series, Forging Texas. You know, you have the great, you know, foundational stories of early Texas, but then to delve into the sixth movie in the series before we made this one, Home, uh-huh. about the brother and sister who are reunited from the Vietnam War after the fall of Saigon. Uh-huh. I mean, I have friends that were boat people and know that story. And when I saw that movie, you know, getting to know Steven, I was in tears. I mean, it was just, I could so relate. And I'm not Vietnamese, but mm-hmm. I have friends that have lived that. And to find out that one of the biggest, you know, Vietnamese diasporas is here in Texas, in Port Arthur, you know, outside of Vietnam, it was fascinating because I didn't know that. And so having that kind of dedication to tell more stories, I hope this series will keep going. I know the original vision was to do 10 movies. This is number 7. I know we're at a bit of a pause right now, but I hope that we will, you know, find a great audience for this movie like the others have. And, you know, Home in particular got into some mainstream festivals and won some awards and got some notoriety. And we hope that the same will happen with the making of the classic.
Making it. It's so important as we, there's a war on history. And I wanted to ask you about that in American history with mm-hmm. the introduction of the narrative of the 1619 Project mm-hmm. and then in Texas with the Forget the Alamo book. Mm-hmm. And it's as if our history can only be black and white.
Yeah.
And
so much more.
And what you see from your story is, yes, it is so much more. Texas is so much more. There are so many stories here. I mean, when you I think the third or fourth most common language in Texas is Tagalog.
Yeah, there you go.
So,
exactly.
You know, second, I mean, yeah. after English and
yeah.
Spanish,
yeah.
Which is big. I wanted to ask you in terms of that divisiveness. So Spencer Williams goes and plays Amos and Andy,
mm-hmm.
and there's almost. He's seen as a stereotypical character, mm-hmm. Reinforcing black stereotypes. There's a lot of reaction against that. Mm-hmm. How did that play out, and what do you think that meant to him?
I think he ended his career on a sad note, uh-huh. from what I've read. You know, he did that show for several years. A lot of people don't know that the original Amos and Andy were two white men who were doing, you know, stereotypical voices on radio.
Uh-huh.
And when they had the opportunity to turn it into a television show, well, by that point, thankfully, you know, blackface had, you know, grown out of favor in the American entertainment space.
Uh-huh.
So they wanted to get real black actors to play it. And so things that I've read, Spencer Williams, you know, really worked really hard behind the scenes to show a lifestyle and to show people that were contemporary to the life he was living and experiencing as a black man in America in Los Angeles at that time. And so I think he was distraught and sullen by the reaction from groups like the NAACP that wanted to end it. And mm-hmm. the show ended prematurely. Did it have problems? Of course. You know, storytelling is wrought with problems, you know, depending on, you know, who's writing and who's performing. But the thing that he was, I think, most perplexed about is he's trying to celebrate the stories of black men and women on television on this new medium, and it wasn't being given a chance to find its voice and to find its way. And so before, you know, it had that opportunity to sort of blossom like, you know, Leave It to Beaver or Father Knows Best or one of those shows or I Love Lucy, you know, it was easier for the networks to fall under the pressure and just close it down. And so to the best of my knowledge, he didn't do anything significant as a performer after that. And, you know, sort of died, you know, I think a heartbroken man in the late 60s. You know, when I was just in Los Angeles in February after we made this movie, we finished it, I made it a point to go to his grave. He's buried in a military cemetery, the federal military cemetery in Westwood in L.A. Found his grave and just went and took my son, who's about to graduate from film school as a filmmaker.
So, and I said, 3 generations.
We're going to go and pay our respects to this man who was a World War One hero, who was a... you know, an entrepreneur, a filmmaker, a collaborator, a person who figured out how to work across differences, not only with Alfred Sack, but with the people who did Amos and Andy. And he was a solutionist, I think. And that's an important thing, you know, to find solutions in the face of adversity. And on this divide about history, I think I heard it best from an old preacher in Dallas, ironically. He's, you know, someone was trying to press him on his political thoughts, and he's like, you know, I don't talk about that because I'm a pastor. And he finally shut the room down by saying, you know, I'm just an old country boy, and I've never seen a bird successfully fly only on its right wing or only on its left wing. It needs both wings to take flight. And I think that's a great lesson in what we need to do in this country. And when I came to this project, you know, I got some sneers from people that were like, you know, the Texas Public Policy Foundation, you're going to work with them? And I said, absolutely. They want to tell this lovely story about black film history, and I'm going to collaborate with them. And they sought me out as a subject matter expert, and we're going to be that bird. You know, we're going to take flight, and we're going to share this story all over the state with the young middle school children that the series is designed for. And I think in the process, if we're blessed and fortunate, some other people will be impacted by it. And I think that's how we make change. And I think story and narrative and collaboration is key. And it's exactly what Alfred Sack, Spencer Williams and Catherine Cavanis did way back in 1941.
I'm on the 1836 Commission, as is our CEO. And we're very committed to telling the whole story of our history. And when you tell history in that way, and you see this with any one person's just going at family tree or looking there, you find it's all there. You've got really good people sometimes do bad things.
Absolutely.
Really bad people sometimes do good things.
Absolutely.
I mean, and everything in between.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
History is the story of that complexity.
Yeah.
It's, you know, sometimes people have a bad life, but one very good day.
Yeah.
And that's the day that counts.
Yeah.
And
that's really good, Sherry.
I want to look at another scene from this film. And then to close up, I want you to tell us what, in looking at this film, what you were looking for, this one thing. I've got two questions. Let's just look at this final scene here. And it's not the final scene, but it's a scene. And I want you to tell me what you see in it.
Absolutely.
Hey, Spencer.
Yes, sir.
You have a minute?
What's wrong?
Nothing.
Well.
A lot. The actor for the day's a no-show.
The husband?
The tavern owner. Can you shoot around him over his shoulder, bring in the crew for standing?
You know I don't like to do that.
I know. Look, I'm sorry. Hey, the location for tomorrow.
The river.
the bedroom. It fell through. The property owner wants double what they discussed.
But we had a deal. His word has to mean something or else we
I wish it were that easy, okay?
The guy's a schlump, trust me. But, I got a friend who has a friend who might have a place we could use.
Yeah, and what if we don't get that in enough time?
Can you shoot around him? Which brings me to another problem, the schedule. Jack says we're running a little slow.
Hey, 12 pages is not slow. It's too fast, if you ask me.
Still leaves us a couple days behind schedule.
May I?
Sure.
Back on schedule. Sorry, Mr. Sack. I need to go check in on Kathy.
Oy vey, Spencer.
Oy vey, Spencer. I love that line.
So the thing that struck me, I mean, there's a lot of things that struck me, but how he took his coat, helped him with his coat off. And that seemed odd. But so was it, that just, and then they then he threw the coat to somebody else. And,
when we shot this, it was like 110 degrees outside. I mean, it was blazing
like it
hot.
Would have been.
Like it would have been when they made the movie. And the other thing was, you wouldn't know it, but we got rained out with a thunder and lightning storm from the dawn of time in the middle of our shoot. We had to shut down. We lost almost half a day of filming. And so all the obstacles that we're telling a movie about and conjecturing that they went through when they were making this movie 83 years ago, we were experiencing in real time ourselves. It was like we were living the movie we were making. The really cool thing about that scene is it embodies the filmmaking process at its core essence, the collision of art and commerce.
Right.
And then the reality of time and money, right? And so he says, we're going over schedule. And he hands him the script, and he takes three pages out and says, now we're back on schedule. Now, John Ford did that to some studio executive on one of his movies. And so that was a nod to John Ford on how he stayed on schedule on a huge Hollywood movie. And so we brought that into this, you know, this
great scene,
this, you know, this thing that Spencer and Alfred are going through. Because, you know, they were working outside of the system, Sherry. This is independent cinema before independent cinema. I mean, this is, you know, Tyler Perry, Spike Lee, Issa Rae, Ava DuVernay, well before those careers could even be imagined, they were daring to do that right here in North Texas in the early 40s. And they did it so well that they managed to make 11 movies together, nine of which Spencer wrote, directed, and starred in. So, I mean, I wish I knew more about how Alfred and Spencer met, but it just fascinates me that these two men from two different cultural backgrounds could meet in a segregated time in a state in the South and do good business together and create art, and art that's longstanding and, you know, now considered to be part of the American cinema lexicon. You know, The Blood of Jesus, as you said in your opening, is the first film made in Texas accepted into the National Film Registry. And yeah, we've been making movies in Texas since the beginning of cinema. I mean, my studio is bordered by Tilly Street, and Tilly Street is a nod to the Tilly brothers who made silent pictures in San Antonio and Austin in the early time of cinema.
That's great.
Yeah. So, you know, it's these kinds of things that, you know, make preserving this story so important, and that we hope school children around the state, you know, will be enthralled by, be, you know, inspired by, and also see a little bit of themselves, like, oh, I could do the impossible. It is possible. As a matter of fact, on every movie that I make, I put a sign on the studio that's a quote from Walt Disney on the door, and it says, it's kind of fun to do the impossible. And that's the mindset that I have to bring into making a movie. And that's what we did when we were doing the making of a classic. We were doing the impossible in 1 week.
Is part of the impossible in that scene that everybody had welched on their agreements?
Yes.
Yeah, so lost this, was that part prejudice, or is that just filmmaking?
You know, it's both. It's both. But we chose to just show it as you know, reality. You're dealing outside of Hollywood. So, you know, a farmer says, oh, you can shoot on my property today. Oh, I'm scared by all these people. You know, I want you to leave. Or, you know, the tavern owner of the, you know, so there, here are these, again, these two diametrically opposed people trying to come together to make something and bring other people into a piece of their dream. And, you know, it's happened to me my entire career as a producer, you know, and so you'd hope and think that it's in this day and age not a racial thing. Mm-hmm. It's just it's dealing with people outside of the machine. And, you know, that's the great thing about Hollywood. When you're in Hollywood and you're at the studios, everything is geared around making movies. It's a film factory.
Uh-huh.
But when you start doing things on location and other places and other states, it's like, oh, yeah, I'll help you. And, you know, things, you know, people, you know, get a little willy nilly sometimes.
Well, before I let you go, we're hoping to get the film Making of a Classic is out in competing now.
In the film festival circuit. Yeah.
Film festival circuit. So we don't have it at ForgingTexas.com, but we will. But yeah. In those little snippets with our last minute or so, what do you look for? So we say, you're a filmmaker, mm-hmm. and you say, this is a classic. This is an amazing film. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of us look at it and it's old and we're used to much flashier films. What do you see in it that makes it a classic for you?
Oh, in the original film?
Yeah, in the original film.
Yeah, the pure determination of telling stories. There's a line in the movie just after the scene that we showed about them at the side of the river. And he says, when audiences look up on that screen, they'll never have experience looking in a mirror. They'll see themselves, and they'll see themselves in you and me, he says to Catherine.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, you know, the beauty of the art form is that ultimately it's a gateway and allows people to open up their imagination and say, I'm seen, I'm heard, I exist. I can tell a story.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's the beauty of the original film, because the audience got to see a fully thought out beginning, middle, and end story of this couple. The wife is devout and goes to church and has a relationship with the Lord. The husband, you know, goes fishing and hunting instead of going to church. There's an accident. His gun falls and she gets shot. And she's on her deathbed, and she has this near-death experience where she goes into heaven and sees hell, and then she recovers and comes back. It's a moving thing for her husband, and it becomes a believer. Even the folks who are believers who go to their church, they're amazed. And so it's this wonderful tale of, like, you know, you take this abstract thing about faith, and then a little thing called life happens.
Uh-huh.
And so the movie captures that. And so I think, you know, if I were to be a good imagination, that folks that look like me in 1941 that had a chance to see that up on the big silver screen were probably absolutely captivated that, you know, a part of their life was on screen, and that all of these characters related to people that they could put a name and face to. Oh, that's just like Jim. That's just like my grandma. That's just like my Uncle Duke. You know, it brought a validation, I think, to mm-hmm. their lives, and they felt seen.
Well, and that's you, and that's the New York Times. They called it magnificent.
Yeah, yeah.
So it will Making of a Classic. But we'll be on at ForgingTexas.com, as I said, as soon as it comes back after having won all the awards on the film festival circuit.
From your mouth to God's ears. We're going to do our level best.
Absolutely. Martin, thanks for joining me today. And thanks to all of you for joining us on the Sherry Sylvester Show. You can catch Martin on a podcast called The Filmmaker Mixer, which he's appearing on this week, last week?
Yes.
So look at that. You can subscribe to The Sherry Sylvester Show at Apple or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow me on X at Sylvester1630. And if you'd like to receive the 9th in Congress newsletter, you can sign up at the TPPF website, www.texaspolicy.com/9thincongress. See you next time.